Hello, welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Shirley Jihad, in for Ian Masters. Ian is taking a rare and well-deserved break. You can always find any episode of the program online at backgroundbriefing.org. Lots ahead for you right now. First, with these latest twists and turns in the Trump-Russia investigation, we broach the topic, what is the threshold for calling for impeachment? The founders of the Constitution created the impeachment powers, raising mostly concerns about election fraud, bribery, traitorous acts, and foreign intrusion. All of those very points seem to be lighting up in the Mueller investigation. We talk with Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe, whose latest book is To End a Presidency, The Power of Impeachment. Then the deadline coming up to sign up for health care. That enrollment window is closing on December 15th. Medicare for All has drawn a surge of support in the heels of the midterm elections. And now a new report says the cost of giving full coverage to everyone is less than sticking with the current private insurance system. We talk with the author of that report, economics professor Robert Polin. And here we are, the final month of 2018, the holiday season. Lots of families are checking their budgets for travel and holiday spending and reflecting on the passing of another year. We explore how the American dream is becoming ever more elusive, how people with middle-class jobs are slipping out of middle-class life. Alyssa Quart joins us. She's the author of Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. The cost of the big essentials like health care, college, and housing have been skyrocketing, while incomes have been flatlining. And now the wealth gap is threatening a bedrock this country has prided itself on, its robust middle class. Joining us now is one of America's foremost constitutional scholars, Lawrence Tribe, is professor of constitutional law at Harvard Law School. He's co-founder of the American Constitution Society. His latest book is To End a Presidency, The Power of Impeachment. Thanks for joining us, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
We have so much to talk about. We want to touch on the implications of the Michael Cohen testimony, the latest in the emoluments issues and lawsuit, and the questions of what a democratically controlled Congress may do going forward. So let's get started. We have the testimony from Michael Cohen that deals with Russia for a Trump Tower Moscow were ongoing well after Trump was the presumptive nominee. Can you break down the implications of that?
Well, the implications are quite profound because they strongly suggest, unless Michael Cohen is completely lying and risking really spending the rest of his life in prison given all the charges against him, what we are confronting is powerful evidence that Donald Trump himself was compromised by Putin and by Russia. Compromised in the fundamental sense that he was hiding from the American people his own financial stake in cutting back on the sanctions against Russian oligarchs and Russian banks, a stake that made all the difference to his ability to go ahead with his long-planned project to have a great hotel, Trump Tower Moscow, in the heart of Russia. That whole project, which the president lied to the American people about when he said that it never got started, it never really took off the ground, it was completely scotched and scuttled early in the year, in fact, was very much on the president's mind as he was going into the convention in Cleveland. That project would have entailed violating the Federal Foreign Corrupt Practices Act by giving a $50 million penthouse to Putin in return for having lots of Putin's billionaire friends buy into the tower. It was a massive project, and it was a project that gave the president a stake in pursuing a foreign policy very different from that in America's own interest. It gave him a stake in lifting the sanctions on the very sources of funding that he would need for this project. And the fact that the project didn't end up getting built, which is part of what the president says, doesn't really prevent the basic point from being true, the point that at least as of the time he was becoming the Republican nominee, the president was acting not in the interest of America, but in his own financial interest, and in a way that Putin knew about, but the American people didn't. And that gave Putin leverage over Trump. And the deepest implication is that he probably still has that leverage, because Donald Trump has never given up his aspirations to become fabulously wealthy, wealthier than he has pretended to be. And that means that almost everything he does in foreign policy, we can't know whether it's in his own financial interest or in the interests of the United States. And that is a grave national security risk.
It is a grave national security risk because we can't tell whether his actions are in his own business interest or in the national interest. If he was
exactly
making these actions during the campaign before being sworn in, is there any lesser legal violation there? In your book, which is very measured and a historic application of impeachment law, a text that will outlast Trump's presidency, but in your book you do point out that actions by a candidate in some cases before inauguration can add up to an impeachable offense.
Well, in fact, one of the central concerns of the framers of the Constitution in designing the impeachment power so that we wouldn't have to wait out a president's term before we got rid of a president who was profoundly corrupt and abusive in his power, one of the main concerns they had was that a president would be beholden to a foreign adversary. And if the president especially achieved his office with the help of such an adversary and owed all his power to that foreign government, that was kind of the paradigm case in which they said, we have to have a way of ridding ourselves of such a president. In the book that I wrote with my former student, Joshua Matz, I explore, however, the great dangers of loose talk about impeachment and of jumping to conclusions and of moving so quickly on the impeachment front, even against a dangerous president, that a large part of the American electorate will feel disenfranchised. It's very important that the impeachment power not be used as a kind of backdoor way of expressing regret about the outcome of a presidential election. It's not a way of redoing the election, of saying, you know, we really wish we hadn't voted this guy in. It's simply a way of focusing on genuine high crimes and misdemeanors, abuses of power that are so dangerous to the republic that the nation comes to a broad consensus that we have to get rid of the particular president, and that we would do so whether or not we agree with his or her policies.
And when do we cross that threshold? Are we reaching that threshold? Have we crossed that threshold?
Well, I think it's certainly premature to say that we have crossed it, because there is not yet the kind of national consensus that would be required. I think we're getting closer in the sense that much of what this president has done would have led to the removal of virtually any other president in our history. But because of the broken politics in which we live, because there is so little consensus about what is the truth, because this president has been so effective in generating a kind of reality bubble of his own and having lots and lots of people, tens of millions of people, move into it with him, we are in a very different kind of world. I mean, in a way, with each passing revelation, with every drip and drop of the many guilty pleas and convictions and cooperation agreements that are revealed from the Mueller camp, people become increasingly inured to the idea of a treacherous and corrupt person in office, so that instead of the latest revelations being explosive, they are simply more of the same. People say, it's already baked in. We already knew that this guy would lie about things. We already had strong reason to suspect that he was beholden to foreign powers, whether it's Putin or Mohammed bin Salman, whether it's Russia or the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. So what else is new? And the very fact that these things pile on and kind of develop a public resistance to thinking that anything truly terrible has just happened creates a danger that we will slip gradually into an authoritarian universe that none of us really bargained for.
We're talking with Professor Lawrence Tribe of Harvard Law School, constitutional law professor, with his latest book, To End a Presidency, The Power of Impeachment. You're talking about the sort of inoculation of this drip of news that causes people to not feel the urgency of what's unfolding before us. So what's the response to that then?
I think the response has to be careful public attention to what is really being revealed. That is, I think, rather than sort of getting hysterical about every latest revelation, people should suspend judgment. They should realize that a lot still more needs to be discovered and known. They should wait to see the investigations by the House Judiciary and House Intelligence Committee. They should wait to see what exactly Mueller has to report. And rather than kind of yelling about how he's got to go, impeach now in the way that guys like Tom Steyer do, I think we have to realize that impeachment is a grave and serious step. It has never in our history resulted in the removal of a president. When it is used loosely and for partisan purposes, as it was against Bill Clinton, it can result in increasing the popularity of a president rather than bringing him to meaningful public account. So we have to hold our fire. We have to wait and learn and see what's going on rather than jumping to conclusions. Either he'll never have to be removed, we have to wait to 2020, or on the contrary, get rid of him now. Both of those are unhealthy responses.
Well, in terms of what's going on right now, there were two or three lawsuits in various courts for violations of the emoluments clause of the Constitution. One lawsuit has survived in D.C., Maryland. The judge in that case is allowing that suit to go forward and gave the green light for discovery. And so there would be more information put forward publicly, perhaps about the president's tax returns and other business dealings. Now the Justice Department, though, is fighting that as of Friday. Can you tell us more about that?
Right. They have taken a rather extraordinary step of saying that what's called a writ of mandamus, which is almost never granted, should halt that lawsuit cold, should just bring it to a close and not wait for appeals of particular matters to go on, and that the lawsuit should be frozen in place. They're obviously afraid of what will be uncovered and revealed in any of the three pending suits challenging the president's violation of these central provisions of the Constitution, which are designed to prevent a president from being beholden to anyone but the American people. And I think the combination of these three suits, which are at various stages of progress, will be very important to finally holding President Trump to account for impermissibly mixing his own personal, financial, and family business interests with the office of the presidency. We haven't in the past had presidents who have used the office simply as a way of enriching themselves and of obscuring the reality of whose interests they are pursuing when they make decisions about tariffs or about holding a foreign prince responsible for the torture and murder of a journalist, or with holding Putin and his fellow oligarchs responsible for what they're doing in Ukraine and elsewhere in the world. We haven't had presidents about whom we had to really ask every day, whose interest are they serving?
Remarkable. We have about a minute left, Professor. Can you share with us your thoughts on Trump's appointed acting attorney general, Matthew Whitaker?
What we do need to do is make sure that the guy that Trump has carefully put in place to supervise and control Mueller is not allowed to suffocate his inquiry. It's important that Whitaker be watched closely so that if any step occurs that is likely to strangle the Mueller inquiry and refuse to give permission for it to go forward, we'll at least be alerted to that and know how to react to it.
Thank you very much, Professor.
Okay, thank you.
We've been talking with Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe. His latest book, To End a Presidency, The Power of Impeachment. I'm Shirley Jihad, sitting in for Ian Masters. Stay with us. Coming up after a short break, we'll talk about a new report that explains why Medicare for All costs less.
And now, a word from the president.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangster. Getting voted into the White House. Everything looking good to the people of the world, but the Murphy family is my boss. The voters of the world keep supporting me, and I promise to take you very far. Other mothers better not upset me, or I'll send a million troops to die at war. To all you Republicans that helped me to win, I sincerely like to thank you.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you
Welcome back. I'm Shirley Jihad, in for Ian Masters. Joining us now is Robert Polin. He's a distinguished professor of economics and co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's done a lot of work as a consultant for the U.S. Department of Energy, the International Labor Organization, the United Nations Industrial Development Organization. He's worked with many U.S. non-governmental organizations on creating living wage statutes, both in state levels and in local levels. His books include A Measure of Fairness, The Economics of Living Wages and Minimum Wages in the United States, also Greening the Global Economy. His latest work is a big report just released on the cost of Medicare for All. Thanks for joining us, Professor.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So basically, you find that at this point, we could have Medicare for All, and it would cost less than the public-private for-profit system that we have in place currently.
That's right.
Tell us about your findings.
The basic findings are very simple and straightforward, even though, as you said, it's a big, fat report. The basic findings are that when we introduce Medicare for All, one of the great The single greatest benefit is that everybody has coverage. Everyone has decent coverage so they can get good health care. So once that is introduced, there will be more use of the health care system because right now people, about 9% are uninsured and about nearly 30 are what we call underinsured because they have insurance but they can't afford to get necessary treatment because of costs. So utilization or demand for healthcare will go up. So we say it'll go up by about 12%. On the other side, though, under Medicare for All, we introduce cost controls in the areas of administration of the system, of drug pricing, the fees that we pay for physicians, and in terms of the efficiency of the service delivery system and cutting back on fraud. Overall, we say Medicare for All can generate savings of about 19%. When you add that all up, you have everybody covered, full coverage with no cost sharing, no copays, no deductibles, and you have about a little less than a 10% savings relative to our existing healthcare system.
So you're defining Medicare for All as what it sounds like. In other words, everybody's covered, as you just said, no copays, no out-of-pocket deductibles,
right,
et cetera. It's become a bit of a campaign slogan, and people mean different things when they say Medicare for All. Sometimes they mean more incremental things, or it's been called Medicare for more, or a few more instead of Medicare for all. But your report advocates the full coverage.
Well, I mean, I personally do advocate it, but that the nature of the report was not so much advocacy, but to assess the proposal in the September 2017 bill introduced into the Senate by Senator Bernie Sanders, and that's the nature of his bill. There are features of the proposal in the Bernie Sanders bill that I myself don't necessarily agree with, and we state that explicitly. But overall, what I'm assessing is, yeah, if we introduce something like the Bernie Sanders bill into the U.S. economy, we can cover everybody with good health care, with no copays, no deductibles, no out-of-pocket at all, and we can still save about a little less than 10% relative to what we're spending now.
And there are other recent reports and other numbers floating around about the cost of single-payer or Medicare for all. And so how do people know, consumers, what to believe if there are conflicting reports out there?
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting things is that the reports are not all that conflicting on one side, which is on how much utilization of the system, how much demand for healthcare services will go up. My study, in which I said we assume it goes up to by 12%, and of course we don't really, really, truly know. We're talking about a $3 trillion system that's going to be affecting 330 million people. So we can't know from one report or two reports or seven reports exactly what the response is going to be by people. But we assume 12%, and we took that to be a high-end number relative to other researchers, and in fact it is. So, for example, the study that came out in July by the Mercatus Institute, which is the Koch brothers-funded institute, and the author of the paper is Charles Blauhaus, he assumed that utilization demand is going to go up by 11.3%. So our number is actually higher, but in any case, we're within range. On the other side, how much savings there is. Well, of the various studies, the Urban Institute put out a study in 2016 around the time of the presidential campaign, except they don't even think about potential savings. So, you know, there's not much to say in terms of their study with respect to savings. In terms of the Mercatus Institute, the Koch brothers-funded institute, their savings number is lower than ours, but it is not dramatically lower than ours. So, you know, in the end, that study also shows that under Medicare for All, and again, this is the Koch brothers' own institute, in their view, Medicare for All is still going to cover everybody and save. And what they showed was over 10 years, it would save $2 trillion relative to running the existing healthcare system for 10 years. We showed over 10 years it would save $5 trillion over 10 years. So, you know, obviously there's a difference between $2 trillion over 10 years and $5 trillion over 10 years, or $200 billion per year versus $500 billion per year. But, you know, we're in the same range. And so, you know, even though obviously our institute that wrote this study is very different than the Mercatus Institute, we're converging around, you know, a basically agreed upon outcome that Medicare for All can succeed in covering everybody decently and save money for the overall U.S. economy and, critically, save money for households and businesses.
It went over well in a lot of places in the country as a campaign slogan in the midterm elections. Sometimes support drops when the idea of taxes going up is added in. But what are the hurdles if there's this agreement that it's going to save $200 to $500 billion a year? What are the hurdles in front?
Well, the biggest ways you save money, and according to our study, when we say we're going to save about 19% relative to the existing system, the biggest source of savings is on administrative costs. So of the 19% total savings, we think Medicare for All can save 9% of the 19% via operating much more efficiently administratively. And secondly, the other big, big source of savings is with respect to drug prices. So we think 6% of total system costs can be reduced through reducing pharmaceuticals. Now, so to your question. Well, on the administrative side, the way we get the big savings is we basically shut down the private health insurance industry. They're not going to be too happy about that idea, so that's a big source of opposition. And secondly, the pharmaceutical companies, we're talking about reducing their average prices for prescription drugs by 40%, and the drug companies are not going to be too happy about that. So those are the fundamental barriers to advancing Medicare for all.
Now, incoming Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez has been documenting her entry into life at the Capitol. This weekend, she says she's frustrated to find that as a waitress, her health care cost was more than double what it's going to be as she becomes a congressman. She says it's frustrating that Congress doesn't just give everybody the same health care that the Congress gets. Is that basically what your plan would be? And can everybody get the health care that congressmen get that we hear about being so good?
Yeah. Well, everybody gets the same level of care. Everybody gets good care. And that's basically it. So congressmen and everybody, her former self as a waitress, they would still get the same level of care within the Medicare for All system, comparable to what exists now for Medicare for people over 65. And that's why I think the term Medicare for All is good. I think it conveys what the reality is, that if you think about the Medicare system for over 65 people today, most people are quite satisfied with it, and everybody gets good care. And that's what would be delivered under Medicare for All just to the rest of the population.
We're talking with Professor Robert Paulin, Distinguished Professor of Economics and Co-Director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and he has a new report released recently on the cost of Medicare for All. We're talking about Congress. 120 members of Congress have signed on as co-sponsors of the House version of Medicare for All. So from your vantage point, what do you expect from this democratically controlled Congress coming up?
Well, I should say, first of all, that the bill in the House is slightly different than the one that Bernie Sanders introduced into the Senate, not dramatically. I think that they need to really advance it, take it forward. I don't know if they will, of course. I don't have a crystal ball, and I certainly don't have any inside scoop. But there, as you said, if 120 of them are co-sponsors, then they better be serious. This is what they promised to their constituents. This is what they have to deliver on. And that's what I expect. I expect them to do what they have committed to do.
Do you think that they might bring things to a vote, even if it's not going to make it through the Senate? We saw the Republican House do that over and over and over and over and over again, talking about repealing they called Obamacare.
Well, I don't know, but I think they should. I think it would make a very powerful statement. Because, at least according to the polls, roughly 70% of the population supports Medicare for All. So let's get it on the record as to who is opposing what 70% of the American people want. If the Republican-controlled Senate is opposed, if they're even going to block consideration of Medicare for All in the Senate, or if they're going to vote against it, then let the American people understand that, because again, this is what the American people want. It's a fairer system. It will create better health outcomes for people. It will dramatically reduce financial anxiety for people who can get into serious financial difficulties, bankruptcies, due to having to cover medical costs under certain situations. So it is a viable system. What my study shows is it works as a financial framework. And actually, the reason it works is quite simple and robust, in that it's working in basically every other advanced economy today. So in terms of, we have a very detailed study which comes out with a simple result that, well, just let's look at other countries and let's do more or less what the other countries are doing, and we will deliver good quality health care for everybody.
Is there any danger of weight of a monopoly kind of system with a single payer system, and should there be some antitrust policies going hand in hand?
Well, in the proposal that we have, I mean, you still have private hospitals, you still have physicians who can operate private businesses. So there is a danger in the area of the large-scale hospitals, which large-scale, there's been a strong move towards hospital consolidation under the Affordable Care Act, and those hospitals need to have their profits controlled. And one of the things that we propose in the study is that hospitals be regulated in a way similar to electrical utilities are regulated in the U.S.
So if the measure that you're researching, Medicare for All, shuts down the private health insurance industry and reduces profits for the pharmaceutical industry, what about the impact on hospitals? Why are the hospitals remaining for-profit institutions and not becoming nonprofit, mm-hmm. for instance?
Well, you could go in that direction. And in fact, the bill in the House does propose that. I was basically responding to the bill introduced by Senator Sanders into the Senate, which does not include the nationalization of all the private hospitals. I think it could be a good move. I think we can get pretty far with regulation of the private hospitals, much the same way as we do reasonably well with regulating the utilities in terms of price and profitability. Now, of course, with the utilities, we have the other massive problem today with burning fossil fuels, but that's an entirely different issue. In terms of regulating their costs, regulating their prices, giving them a fixed rate of allowable profitability, the utility regulatory structure, I think, works reasonably well. So I think we could be okay. But, yeah, I'm open to the idea of nationalizing the private for-profit hospitals.
How do you bridge perceptions and realities when it comes to health care? Single payer was doomed for so long. The words socialized medicine were such an anathema, and there have been variations on that with the death panels and other things. So how do you bridge perceptions and realities if the goal is to get health care for all?
You know, I confess I'm not really an expert and on public relations and messaging, but, you know, I tried to do my best by writing the most honest, rigorous possible study I could. I believe it's the most detailed, extensive study ever written about Medicare for All. We went through an extremely rigorous review process by 12 experts in the field who I basically had never met any of them in person. I met a couple of them over the weekend, but you know, when I first asked them to review our study, I didn't know them at all. That was deliberate. They're high-level experts. Many of them have criticisms of our study, and I posted the study, their criticisms online, along with our study, so everyone can see what the concerns are, and that's fair. But the point is that the study has been peer-reviewed, criticized, and we've done revisions, and the net result is an honest study, which I think tells a story which is broadly accurate. Of course, it's not going to be accurate in every single detail, but it's broadly accurate, and I think it confirms the viability of Medicare for All as a basis for delivering high-quality health care and cost controls.
Thank you very much for joining us, Professor.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We've been talking with Professor Robert Polin. He is Distinguished Professor of Economics, and he is co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And he is the author of a report released just last week on the cost of Medicare for all. I'm Shirley Jihad, in for Ian Masters, and after this short break, we'll be back with a conversation with the author of Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America.
And so no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. All we've got, no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. We need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth. And those pills make me.
Welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Shirley Jihad, in for Ian Masters. And with us now is Alyssa Quart. She is executive editor of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. It's a nonprofit journalism organization focusing on income and wealth inequality. She also writes the column Outclassed for The Guardian. Her work has appeared in publications, including The New York Times, The Atlantic, The New York Review of Books. She is executive producer of the Emmy Award-winning Showtime documentary Jackson, and she writes poetry. Her poetry has appeared in the London Review of Books and in The Nation. Her latest book out now, book of nonfiction, called Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. Welcome, Alyssa.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for joining us. You know, your book is so well reported. You bring together both the big picture and these really intimate individual stories and portraits of people's lives in America at this time when a lot of people are feeling that squeeze. So why don't we start with a setup, set the table for us, paint the big picture of what's happening. The numbers are so telling about how people feel the squeeze. One of the numbers that come to mind is the doubling of the cost of college, the doubling of the cost of health care in the last couple of decades while salaries are flat. Can you sort of paint a picture of the reality of the numbers right now for us in America?
Yeah, absolutely. College, public university and college has doubled in cost since 1996. There was a study that was done about mobility, which is another marker that shows that people who were born in the 1940s had a 92% chance of making more money and being more, quote-unquote, successful than their parents. And people born in the 80s have a 50-50 chance by the time they're 30 of being as successful as their parents. And then you have things like the cost of real estate, healthcare, daycare, and indeed kind of flatlining wages, something like increasing by 0.3%, whereas CEO and upper management pay has skyrocketed.
So you're talking about that wealth gap, and as it is ever widening, you describe more and more people entering what you call the falling middle class vortex. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I entered it myself when I was pregnant with my daughter 8 years ago. I was a freelance journalist, as was my husband. We were older parents, and we were like actually pretty reasonably successful as far as journalists go, but the problem was we were buying our own health care. We didn't have a stable long-term plan or savings that would tide us till we were old. And also, you know, we suddenly had to pay daycare expenses for our daughter. And all that just put us into this free fall where it was, okay, we've got to get stable jobs. That's a whole other story I could tell you. And then it made me start having these conversations with people I knew, people at my daughter's daycare, people in my network, and then further out reporting around the country about people, librarians, lawyers, professors, teachers, journalists, indeed, who were dealing with many of the same things we were dealing with and who had it much, much worse than we did. We had savings. which is very unusual. There's something like 73% of people can't pay a $500 deductible if they have to, an emergency in America right now. So we were lucky we would have had savings for a while to tide us over, but that's just not the case for most people.
That's such a remarkable number. It sounds you're saying three-fourths of Americans don't have $500 in the bank in case of an emergency?
Is that something like that. Yeah, I'd have to double-check, but it's extreme. And people say they live paycheck to paycheck. I think something like 60% of people said that. And there are different ways to think about it. Some people said, you know, what that meant to them, you know, what they thought that meant living paycheck to paycheck. But it's definitely something that's now affecting the middle class. We think of people living paycheck to paycheck as it's like a working poor thing, but and not even a working class thing. But now it's a huge bunch of Americans are living in this way.
And as we move more into the gig economy, this is just going to increase, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is part of what it means to live in a contingent world where your professional trajectory just isn't as clear as it was when my parents were, you know, choosing their professions 40 or 50 years ago. At that time, they were thinking, you know, oh, okay, I'm going to be a professor. It has certain milestones. You know, I get a graduate degree, I get a PhD, I get my first job. And so much of that, that sort of the ladder of a life, the trajectory, the arc of a life for middle-class professions has changed rapidly. And I think that's part of what was fascinating to me in Squeeze. All these people's lives had changed economically, but also existentially and psychologically to the point where they thought they were making choices that would make them secure and make their lives meaningful. And often it was, you know, on shaky ground that they were standing on.
Well, you start the book telling us about a woman who says she feels like her debt is following her like a monster, like a child's monster in the dark. And she shares her story, which is kind of an example of what you're talking about, right? She did all the right things in terms of going to college, wanted to be a professor. Explain that story.
So, yeah, Michelle, she's a tech librarian in Minnesota. Actually, she got retrained to become more technologically savvy. She been a straight-up librarian originally, I think. And she was married to a guy who did IT. They had a baby. The baby had some health complications, but was a very big baby, and so it was hard. You know, the cost of giving birth was high. And then she had the student debt from the graduate degrees and the undergraduate degrees that was still following her. But, you know, these two people were making what would seem on paper to be a decent salary. But when I first spoke to her, she was living in a one-bedroom apartment, you know, sleeping in the same room with her child, and it was which has its own problems, right, when you're a small family, and was just so worried about all this debt that she had accrued.
You know, she's one of the people whose stories you share. A lot of them are of what used to be considered sort of this professional class, professor, adjunct professor, lawyers, librarians, teachers, many of these people now hovering near the poverty line. Can you tell us more about that? You call them highly educated, downwardly mobile.
Yeah, so I actually came up with a term to describe some of the people I interviewed for this book, the hyper-educated poor, because they had done a study of people with PhDs on food stamps, and it was like over a three-year period, the number tripled of those who had PhDs who were on food stamps. This was after the 2008 recession, and when I saw this number, I was like, wow, I'm going to talk to some of these people, because again, this is an example. You get these advanced degrees. You think you're sort of following by the rule book. You know, you're doing what we've been told to do, like get educated, you know, specialize, be professionalized, right? These are another ways of thinking about what makes someone middle class. Like, do they have higher degrees, right? Advanced education. And so they would do these things, and then they'd wind up, some of the people I spoke to, one was in a trailer park, another was an adjunct professor in Illinois, and he couldn't afford to buy his kids ice cream, he said, or to get them piano lessons. And he described serving them potatoes for dinner. And he was teaching around the clock. He was teaching at all these different colleges. He had a PhD in history. He thought things would be different. And those are really eye-opening, those stories.
Because in those cases, as that example shows, the adjunct professor is making a couple or $3,000 or $4,000 per class, right?
And this guy was making $1,700, which when I actually gone out on the road and talked to people, whenever I say, I can't believe it, they make $3,000 a class, I'd get callers saying, oh, I make $1,500 a class. That $3,000 is high. So when you think about that, what that equals per hour is it's definitely below minimum wage. You know, you're grading, you're preparing, and in order to get enough classes, you also have to commute. So they're commuting from colleges to colleges, these adjuncts, and that often is expensive and time-consuming. So what struck me also about that particular story, that guy's story, Justin, was that it looked like some of the working poor people I'd also written about who were doing retail work or working in, you know, restaurant franchises, because they are also commuting, right? They're going, and sometimes they don't even have cars, right? They're taking buses, and it's hours to get to various jobs and going to different jobs. Mm-hmm. And this, again, was not supposed to be a middle-class narrative where we're supposed to work one place, you know, for most of our lives and commute, you know, the cliche commute, right, was the commuter train, right, out of John Cheever, you know, short stories, right? It was 50 minutes door-to-door. And now there were people I was talking to who were traveling an hour and a half or even 2 hours to get to supposedly middle-class jobs.
Well, this blurring of the latter that you describe, it used to be so clear, and now there's not a clear sort of path. It's affecting younger generations even more. People coming up into the future are having even less structure. What does it look like for the younger millennials and the Gen Xers?
Yeah, so that was striking to me, too. I mean, when I spoke to people in their 30s who had children, and even younger people in their 20s, they would tell me, you know, by now my parents had children. These would be lawyers or people aspiring to be in business, even, you know, HR. But they'd say, you know, I can't afford to have kids. So they were putting off having kids often, and that interested me. And then I found the numbers on this, and the birth rate is the lowest since 1978. In America. And there was a study done recently that where people said, millennials said, the reason for this is because they were worried about not being able to afford their kids. So again, the relationship that I was seeing in my book, between, especially for women, between having kids and not making enough and not being able to call yourself stable, middle class, have the American dream, a lot of millennials are recognizing this before people of my generation did. So that means that often they're not having kids, or they're having one kid, which is, you know, not a tragedy. I have one kid, partially for the same reason, frankly. But what's interesting is it just has really changed the way people see the course of their lives. And it's sort of what struck me reporting this is sort of unspoken, like a silence around it. Like, I don't think I've talked to millennials or people my age that much before I wrote this book about how they were thinking about how many kids they were going to have and whether they could afford to have more than one or any, and how much money had to do with it. People don't like talking about money in this country.
Well, it was interesting that you say that, you know, about affording kids. There's also the idea of affording rent or being able to buy your first home, and it came into more full relief with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talking about rent in Washington, D.C., and being in some quarters criticized because she talked about that.
Yeah, I adore her. I mean, everybody seems to. But, I mean, you know, from the she's an interesting case to me because she's being class-shamed online, right, about her outfit, elegantly dressed, from either side. People either saying, oh, she's too elegant, or, you know, how can it be that she doesn't have enough money for an apartment or have any savings? And it's like, it's as if so much of the elite in this country just don't even recognize what a aspiring middle-class millennial's life looks like. I mean, her life looks like many young people's that I know, you know, and that is another way we can think about this, about how out of touch the very wealthiest and most powerful are from even the, you know, top quarter of earners in this country, like how their experience just doesn't match up. They don't seem to understand what most people's lives are like.
Right. There's certainly changes in the workforce, in the workplace related to technology, and job types are changing because of different technology, et cetera. But we're talking about issues around mobility and upward or downward mobility happening right now in America. So how does the U.S. compare to other countries? I mean, we think of ourselves, Americans think of themselves as having this sort of bedrock of the robust middle class in America and very proud of that. I recently, though, saw a headline. It said something like, "The American dream is alive and well, ... in Canada."
Yeah, well, I think whoever wrote that is not alone. I mean, I've definitely had that thought myself. When you think about, for instance, and this is something I found out when I was reporting my book, I'd gone to some conference in Montreal, and I met these young academics again who had little kids, two little kids, and I think they were in their late 20s. And then I was like, how is this possible? They're graduate students. And then I found out, you know, a daycare in Quebec is $7 to $20 a day, which anybody who has kids knows is very good price, and it's, you know, state subsidized. So that was just one way between that and, you know, paid leave in Canada and health care in Canada. Start to wonder, you know, maybe we should move to Canada, but can we move to Canada?
Well, beyond moving, what about maybe changing things here? How did all this start anyway? This income gap widening, wealth gap widening isn't just a happenstance, right? It's something that kind of has a result of quote-unquote tax reform that ended up sort of lowering taxes for the most wealthy, starting what, in the Reagan era, right?
Yeah, so it starts with tax reform. It starts with, for poor people, it starts with Clinton and, you know, kind of welfare reform, where people are pushed off the welfare rolls. And you just see a lot of people's lives, a lot of professions, also the protections within jobs in corporate sector being dismantled. We also can see, if look in terms of childcare, which is a big factor for the people in my book, in 1971, the year before I was born, there was a victory when Congress passed the Comprehensive Child Development Act, which was, you know, addressed the rising demand for daycare. But then Nixon vetoed the bill later that year. So that sort of made the rest of our lives really hard, and that started before I was born. So this has been going on. It's not just a Trump thing, as much as it can sometimes feel like it is, but it's sort of a lack of care, in a sense, of from our government for parents, for families, for working families of all stripes, and you can see the ramifications now.
Right. And a lot of people are feeling the ramifications, are feeling the squeeze, right? And part of your message in the book is you're not alone. This isn't your fault. You say this is systemic. But that idea kind of can fly in the face of that very American ideal of individual responsibility. So talk a little bit about that. Square that for us. Yeah.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I found there's ways in which the middle class also, did get sort of support when in earlier periods, the GI Bill, even, you know, kind of roads, the development of roads in America, like highways, helped commuters and the suburbs that the middle class lived in get built, right? So there was all this kind of hidden support from the government. But now I think it's hard for people to ask for things and to admit that they're struggling, and our government isn't doing the kinds of things, the kind of stealth support for the middle class that it once did, like the GI Bill, right? It just isn't there. And one thing that interested me is how stigmatized the people I spoke to and interviewed felt about their careers and the fragility of their economic lives and their kids. It didn't stop them from wanting to talk. I think they really wanted people to know what it was like out there for them. But I think it definitely, they didn't think, oh, this is a broad-based problem. They may have known that intellectually, and they could sort of give that lip service, but it always went at every conversation, like, what did I do wrong? I must have done something wrong. Why am I here now? And that kind of broke my heart sometimes when I heard people talking like that, because I felt it was this sense of shame that had been basically transferred from our government that should be helping at least a little bit some of these people, like with some kind of subsidized daycare or universal pre-K or whatever, and it's sort of been transferred onto the individual. So then they're like, what's wrong with me? Why can't I figure out where to put my kid during the day when I'm working all these different jobs? And it was hard to hear sometimes. It was distressing.
you talk about people's sense of fragility and that distress and that I must have done something wrong sensibility. And you also talk about the effect of the squeeze even more on mental health, mental clarity, decision making, as people are grappling with the details of trying to cover all they have to cover. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, I sort of think about it as decision fatigue, which is a term from social science and psychology, which is when people get sort of exhausted almost by the obstacles that are in their path. And we may be familiar with this, although there is this whole bootstrapping thing about the working poor, like, why can't they figure this out? You know, why can't they figure out how to get, you know, that third bus to their job or whatever, you know, or when they're evicted, a new house. Okay, so there is a lot of prejudice, but I think for middle-class people that are trained, almost one of the definitions of being middle-class is to live in sort of a secrecy about your monetary situation. Privacy, right, is kind of one of the fundamental historical parts and constitutive parts of being middle class. So these people are not going to be admitting that they're having trouble with their house payments and so forth. And so part of what I really wanted to do in this book was to get open the doors, open the floodgates, and have people understand that there are other people like them and they're not alone. And they should be able to talk to their friends and colleagues and family and their kids about what's going on with them economically, and then maybe through that start thinking of either electoral solutions or more personal solutions.
You talk about the book and your hope that it opens the door and sheds some light and allows for some conversation. What do you think now is the way forward?
Well, there's a range of things, right? I mean, so I keep rabbiting on about universal basic income, which is a basic income guarantee. They've been trying that out in Stockton, California, and parts of Ontario and Canada, where they give families and individuals, say, $1,000 a month, or in the case of families, $2,000 a month, to supplement their income and to make their lives slightly easier. And when I read about that, I realized, wow, that would be just the right amount for many of the people in this book. It would basically often just cover their daycare. And then I was like, what if we could have universal basic income just for people who do care for their family members, just to cover the person who has their mom in their home and they're caring for them and they're spending hours when they could be generating income caring for their mom, or they have two kids and they're taking care of their kids after school, as most parents do, and they need that little extra bump of income. So what if we had a UBI that was focused on care? So that was one idea. And then some other ones are things like universal pre-K, which was tried out in New York City. They went from 20,000 to 68,000 seats in a 2 or 3 year period. And that every parent I talked to said it had made a huge difference. So not only were they kids not in a costly daycare situation, but they were somewhere safe. And they were somewhere where they're learning the alphabet, you know? And I mean, little things like this. I mean, you could say, oh, that's so expensive. But when we think about America's one of the wealthiest countries, or the wealthiest country by some metrics in the world, why can't we afford universal pre-K for our smallest citizens? And then one other way forward, I think, is we just need to start voting differently. And the midterm elections, at least the Democrats who won, to me, show that there have become new alliances between precarious middle-class people, I call them the middle precariat, and working-class precarious people. You know, people talk about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but there are a lot of other people around this country who've been, you know, winning in the House, who seem to recognize that we need to talk directly to a range of different economic insecurity, not just, you know, the poorest people, but also the kind of people I write about, and yoke these two populations together into a coalition so that they can be more effective.
Thank you so much for joining us, Alyssa.
Oh, you're welcome, Shirley. Thank you.
We've been talking with Alyssa Quart. She is executive editor of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. It's a nonprofit journalism organization. It focuses on issues around income and wealth inequality. And she is the author of Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. I'm Shirley Jihad, sitting in for Ian Masters, and this has been Background Briefing. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to producer Graham Fitzgibbon, also board operator Gary Bach. DACA. Find the program at backgroundbriefing.org. Sign up for email updates and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Please also rate and review us at iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And share the program today with friends or family, colleagues. You can do that on Twitter and Facebook. Background Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time with journalist Kevin O'Leary sitting in for Ian. Until then, have a great day.
Just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305.